mystery involved too?
It's not necessarily a murder mystery, but it's a mm-hmm. it's a horror story. It's a story of murder and horror.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of the things that I've seen about Hidden, there's reenactment of a famous and unsolved murder that occurred 20 years ago. What was it, and how has researching that event directly affected the development of Hidden?
Yeah, that's actually fiction. That murder didn't actually occur.
Okay.
But what we want is we want to build that fiction for an audience that sees the show so that they believe that they're watching a reenactment of murders that occurred. And the story is that play begins as if you're on a tour put on by this tour company called Murder with a View, mm-hmm. and they do reenactments of famous murders and deaths all over the world. And so you're on one of their tours, or they're reenacting this murder that occurred in the forest. And then gradually, throughout the tour, you go from observing to being the observed.
I see. So let's talk about the format of what you just said, becoming the observer, then becoming the observed. So this is an interactive form of theater, so the audience is a participant. How does this format aid in telling the narrative of this performance?
Yeah, so for me, I believe that it's really hard to make horror theater. You're so safe in theater as an audience. There's a very clear line where the audience and the stage begins, and so you know that you're safe.
Mm-hmm.
But with site-specific immersive theater, you don't know that you're safe. You're right in with the action. So there's no clear barrier, and I think that that's the best way to really scare an audience. So in our show, an audience is in a van, and then they're up on a walkway, and then they're walking through the forest in the dark. They're right in mm-hmm. with the actors experiencing, and people right next to them get murdered. It's a really close, intimate experience that I think really leads to a feeling of fear.
You and your creative team were inspired by classic horror movies. Which horror movies played a critical inspiration for Hidden?
Yeah, my initial inspiration was to try to do the Blair Witch Project live.
Wow.
So the idea was that we'd have a bunch of, you know, not to tell that same story, but to recreate that experience. So we'd have a whole bunch of audience members in the woods, in the dark, and they'd know that they were unsafe, but they wouldn't know exactly why, and they wouldn't know exactly where the threat was coming from. So really, Blair Witch was a big one for me. And then Sebastian, who wrote the script, is really inspired by 90s slasher flicks.
Mm-hmm.
So we've taken a lot of those tropes, those classic tropes of, you know, the slut who dies first and the virgin and the, you know, like those kinds of ideas, and we've sort of played with those, and then as the play carries on, we've subverted them.
Can you tell us what it was like to work with Sebastian Archibald? He was the playwright and also the co-director.
He's also my husband.
Oh, so right.
We have a long history of working together. We've run the company together for almost 10 years, and we've worked a lot with him as playwright actor and me as director.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the first time that we've co-directed together. And it's been a great experience. We bring different viewpoints, and it's such a gift as a director to get to work with the playwright, because sometimes you have questions and he's there to answer them, and he's there to kind of lead us in the right direction so we make sure we're telling the story the way it was intended to be told.
So how integral is the role of the audience participant in Hidden?
Incredibly integral. The show couldn't happen unless we had a full van of people. They are basically a cast member. They'll really feel like you're a part of the show. No one ever touches them or threatens them in any way, but they are talked to throughout the experience.
I see. And as you mentioned that they're as important as a cast member, do they have any specific roles that are given to them unbeknownst to them?
No, what they are is just people that are on the tour. So they're mm-hmm. audience, they're people that have paid to go on this Murder with a View tour, and as I said, that falls apart.
Well, what drew you into this kind of site-specific meta theatrical kind of performance? I know this is at UBC Botanical Garden. Why that location as well?
Well, because they have the canopy walkway here, or the canopy tree walk. I don't know if you've ever been up on it, but it's this suspended walkway that runs all through the sort of deep wooded portion of the garden. It goes up to four, or we're taking the audience up to four stories in the air. It goes up to six stories.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just suspended between trees. It's this kind of suspension bridge, which is quite incredible. And so the audience is up there, and they're able to look down on the action below, which provides an amazing vantage for storytelling.
I see. And did you ever do any other site-specific meta theater prior to Hidden, or is this kind of like, I wanted to try this out, and now I'm going to?
No, It's a Zoo's always done site-specific theater. That's been what we've done from the very beginning. I've always been really intrigued by the experience that it creates for the audience. Like I said before, the way that it kind of catches them off guard in a unique way, and I think makes them sit up and engage with the piece in a way that they wouldn't necessarily do if they were safe in their theater seat. And I also really like playing with real sites. That's always interesting as an artist to look at a site and be inspired by a site for what kind of story you want to tell. So we came up with the idea for Hidden, and then we found this venue and adapted the story and the way that the play evolved to this venue.
So does the play kind of lead into the venue, or has it ever occurred where the venue led into a play?
It's been both ways for us. It kind of depends on the production. Generally, we have a concept, and then the concept is really evolved by the venue. This one, very early on, we picked the garden, so this one's very much connected to the botanical garden.
I see. And can you tell me a little bit more about It's a Zoo? So you guys are very, very focused in bringing the audience in and immersing them with the meta theater that you guys do.
Yeah.
Will your future works, if you'd like to tell us, will they also include meta theater as well?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the production. So we like to create plays, we say, for daring audiences. So every time you see one of our shows, you're going to be challenged in some way, whether that be us bringing you out into a cold, rainy forest to watch murder happen, or, for example, our next play is called The Pipeline Project, and it's happening at the Gateway Theater in the spring. And that's a play that started as a story about pipelines and that were being proposed through BC, and we teamed up with a couple of really well-known Aboriginal artists, theater makers, and basically just started down and sat down, and for a couple years I've been talking to them about this. And what's evolved is a play that is about climate change and reconciliation and the connection between our personal culpability as Canadians and our connection to the land and the way that that's connected to climate change and our oil consumption. And so it's a piece that really delves deeply in a really personal way into kind of the big political topics of the day. And so that will be for a daring audience in a different way, because you have to be willing to engage in a very real conversation. So yeah, I mean, it's always different for us depending on what the show is and what the story is.
Definitely. Sounds like you guys are doing a lot of different things, but also the main core is bringing the audience with you guys in that emotional journey.
Absolutely. That's it. For us, it's always about the audience. We almost always have really small audiences. This show is an audience of 13. We generally try to keep the audiences, you know, around 50 and not more, because then we're actually getting to really talk to them. We can look them in the eye. We can have a real communication. They can feel integral, because that, for me, is the point of theater, is to have a conversation with as many people as possible.
Well, thank you so much for your time. That seems really incredible. Again, if people are interested, and I very much recommend it, especially for local UBC students, since it is, you know, quite local. The show is called Hidden. It's starting on October the 22nd to November the 13th at UBC Botanical Garden. And just a question for you, Chelsea. Is it rain or shine?
It is rain or shine. There's one circumstance where we won't do it, which is if there are severe wind warnings. And I should also say, before I get off the phone, that we are currently sold out.
Wow.
But we are looking at doing a holdover. We're looking at potentially adding performances. If not, we'll likely do a remount next year. So if people want tickets, they should, if they want to be put on the waiting list, they should email me at info@itsazoo.org, and I personally will put them on the waiting list.
Well, thank you so much again, Chelsea Haberlin, the director of It's a Zoo and Hidden, which will be coming up October 22nd to November 13th at UBC Botanical Garden. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This month's issue of Discorder is purple. And you know, purple is the new green with envy.
You're turning violet.
The October issue features interviews with Puzzlehead, Swim Team, Kai Plant, and Poxy Sun on their new and upcoming movie. We address the uncertainty of the Trans-Pacific Partnership for Artists and sit down with the organizers of Japanese Poets North of the 49th to discuss reconciliation through poetry. It's your
birthday. Thanks to this month's sponsors, Vinyl Records, Recruiting Canada, the Rickshaw Theater, Fringe Festival, Zipcar, Jazz Records, the Astoria, the UBC AMS, Don't Argue, Redgate, Print, SFU Community Engagement, Live Van, the Vancouver Art Book Fair, the Rio Theater, the Vancouver International Film Festival, Vancouver New Music, and Timber Concerts. Pick up a free physical copy of Discorder around town or read online at discorder.ca. You like, we gon' ride around the city, I'm gon' make your night, eat your cake, bake you off a...
Liveband.com is Vancouver's community-driven concert calendar. New shows are added daily by the city's most active promoters, musicians, and by the driving force of the music scene, the fans. Liveband.com's listings are different because they are integrated with profiles updated by bands and business owners as they promote upcoming events. Check out the archives to see how closely we've worked within the community to put on the shows you love. Visit livemusicvancouver.com for the latest independent and major label event listings. Liveband.com, Vancouver's community-driven concert calendar.
And welcome back to the Arts Report, guys. You're listening to CITR Radio 101.9 FM, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory in Vancouver.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's a good time to be in Vancouver around this time of year, because one thing I realize about this is that within the past 2 months, I've covered Fringe, we've covered Fringe, we've covered VIFF, and now we've covered the Writers' Festival.
The Writers' Festival? What?
Oh, yeah, yeah, that was, we had, you think my lead-in was subtle enough? It's like Donald Trump, you know, I finally got a working microphone.
Oh my gosh.
I joke.
Anyway, the International Vancouver's Writers' Festival was, you've just missed it, but we did talk about it on our shows last week and the week before. It started on the 17th, went to the 22nd, had so many wonderful writers from not only all around the world, but local writers here as well, like Canadian and even in BC, had wonderful panels with all sorts of different topics, ones that are like kind of like, you know, for like children, other ones that are very much more, I guess, adult. And Jake, you had the pleasure of actually going to a few of the panels. Could you tell us more about them and actually what your interest was in the Writers' Festival itself?
So the first one I went to was Shakespeare and Cervantes. And I'm very interested in that because Shakespeare and Cervantes are very instrumental figures in what we now know. In literature, yes, but also everything that comes from that. So almost all media that currently exists owes something to it. TV Tropes actually has a word for it, the zeroth law of trope examples.
What does that mean?
You can trace pretty much any trope in current fiction back to, in this case, Shakespeare.
Really?
Same thing you can do with, like, blues-based music and Robert Johnson. You can do that, more or less. It's just, he founds that.
Yeah.
Founded the art form to that degree. And Cervantes is the person we owe more or less for the creation of the novel.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, Don Quixote is considered by many to be one of the first novels and the first definite installation of that art form.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very good book. It's a very long book.
Quixote?
Yeah. Yeah, read it?
Yes.
I read that a while ago. When did you read it?
I read it, like, I think I had to read it for a college, university class or something like that, but I don't know why, but when I get older, I just can't, like, focus anymore when it comes to reading. I feel so, like, upset about this.
Yeah, you
but have to... Quixote does meander back and forth quite a bit.
It is,
like, the
weirdly...
author, like, is in the book, and, like, he's talking about the character, and he's like, nah, that didn't happen.
Weirdly metafictional, weirdly episodic. Yeah, it is a strange piece of literature.
It originated a lot of things.
It did, yeah. Like, the word Lothario, for example, that's a that's the character there, Lothario, who is a Lothario. Particularly bad one at that.
Just
a terrible friend. But Shakespeare and Cervantes actually, according to many sources, died on the same day.
Oh.
Which is actually the only definite date because their birth dates, at least Shakespeare's, are not known exactly because Shakespeare, like, the only records are baptismal, so their exact birth date has a margin of error at about...
Yeah, it says Miguel de Cervantes, I hope I'm saying it at least a little bit correctly.
Cervantes Saavedra, yeah.
Yeah, April 22nd, 1616. Yep, and it says along that of William Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And... This panel, yeah. It's weird to say panel because there were only two people and a moderator.
Oh, really?
And for me, a panel entails something larger, but that is the name. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Would that be the panelists of that panel?
So one of them was a author who, very, very multinational guy, lives in New York and London. He's of Egyptian descent, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And the other was a Spanish author.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically, what went on is that they were both part of a project where six English language authors wrote six short stories based on Cervantes, mm-hmm. and the reverse happened with Spanish writers who wrote something based on Shakespeare. Now, the Spanish writer, Marcos, he actually, so basically he, when he was asked to talk about Cervantes, because they were asked to talk about their own, their local sort of, if you could say, work first, Don Quixote is taught in the Spanish school system,
okay.
but it's not taught very well, according to him.
According to him, it is
a dense book, and it is an odd read. It's not something, honestly, that is very much, despite some its influence, it's not really like anything that I can think of.
It does stand on its own.
He did compare it to Tristram Shandy and Tom Jones, mm-hmm. which are two English novels that, if you're in English, as I am, you will study.
Yeah.
And that seems accurate because the English were really influenced by Cervantes, probably more than the Spanish, even though the Spanish are the ones who consider him a national treasure.
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, because there's the tradition of the novel in England, according to him, again, is definitely more pronounced than it is in Spain.
Mm-hmm, it is.
And his challenge was to write about Shakespeare. So in relation to that, in relation to his knowledge of Cervantes, his knowledge of Shakespeare was actually more in-depth because he preferred English literature.
Hmm.
And Shakespeare is, of course, rooted heavily in that.
Yeah.
And what he did was he didn't want to write something about Hamlet. He definitely said, I don't want to write something about Hamlet. So he starts writing this sort of pastoral theme, sort of, mm-hmm. and lo and behold, Hamlet appears.
He didn't even, but he's just like, mm-hmm. dang it, it's Hamlet.
They read small excerpts from their stories, which the thing about this event was that I sat through the whole thing.
Yeah.
And there was surprisingly little content in what was read that seemed to me anyway to correlate between Cervantes and Shakespeare
mm-hmm.
on any level. I tried to buy the Book of Stories, but they sold out very quickly.
Oh, okay.
Which I get. It did sort of tease in that regard.
Yeah. The one thing about, and people always think like, oh, Writers Fest is like very niche. It's actually quite populated. A lot of the panels were sold out.
Well,
filled up because these authors that are coming in, people go like, authors aren't celebrities. They are quite powerhouses.
Well, for Writers Fest, I'll add that if you're willing to spend $20 on a ticket to a Writers Fest event, you're very likely going to be able to afford to buy a book at the bookstore.
Mm-hmm. And would you say that these panels were worth the ticket price?
Were they worth the ticket price? That was an interesting part for me because mm-hmm. – I came there, and for Shakespeare and Cervantes anyway, Writer as Citizen, actually, I got a bit more out of. Shakespeare and Cervantes was not very impactful to me mm-hmm. about Shakespeare or Cervantes. I think that would be best served in the fiction regarded. Like, if there was anything about the role of Shakespeare or Cervantes, and I actually asked a question about that.
Oh,
what do
it?
You think is the best adaptation or best form of that work that survives?
Mm-hmm.
Which, for Cervantes, maybe less so, but definitely for Shakespeare, is the key to it. And they touched on that. There's these universal human emotions in Shakespeare. That's what most people will tell you is the reason for its success. There's mm-hmm. many Shakespeare adaptations out there. There's a wonderful YouTube show, it's an internet show called Brows Held High,
mm-hmm.
that has an event called Summer of Shakespeare, where this guy does episodes on adaptations of Shakespeare, from Forbidden Planet to Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet mm-hmm. to the, what was it, the Titus... The Julie Taymor movie.
Titus and Andromeda?
Yeah, Titus Andronicus. The Julie Taymor movie with Anthony Hopkins and Jessica Lange.
Oh, okay.
That's an amazing movie, but not for you with a weak stomach.
Okay.
But Cervantes, and to a degree, has shaped the format of literature, too.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't really say how that happened. They said how it affected them.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of generalities. The other novelist, Hisham Hiya, is actually... Mm-hmm. Spoken a lot of these, and I this is no disrespect to him or to either of them, but I found that there was a lack of substance in that regard. Like, I was unclear.
You wanted more of the two powerhouses that were put on the title.
Yes, and I mm-hmm. think that...
And that's completely, like, fair criticism.
Yeah, and, there was a question, there was some regard of this, is that they did mention a few adaptations, like Olivier's Hamlet,
mm-hmm.
as being a great adaptation. And I've seen a lot of adaptations of Hamlet.
Yes.
My father likes the Olivier version a lot. I enjoy the Kenneth Branagh version. I covered the Benedict Cumberbatch version on mm-hmm. this event, on this very show,
you
actually,
did.
Last
you
year.
Did. Yeah.
And that was it was a good production. Hamlet is a very heavily adapted play,
mm-hmm.
and The thing about it, that the Olivier version to them is that Olivier was able to mix this component of the sadness but also the humor, which is what I saw in Cumberbatch and which I also saw in Brana. And I don't know if Olivier's version has aged particularly well because of his style of acting. I think it's still a classic and deserves to be seen because a classic can still be of its time, especially with film that captures that so much.
Yes.
But that is something that has to be realized. And also Orson Welles was mentioned. And Orson Welles is responsible for many great aspects of film and cultural history in the last century. Mm-hmm. And one of those things is Chimes at Midnight, which is a collection of basically fragments from five Shakespeare plays that feature John Falstaff, one of Shakespeare's most detailed characters over his fictional appearances. Mm-hmm. And the great thing about that one from Orson Welles was that Falstaff was witty, somewhat cowardly, very erudite, but also gluttonous and tricky, and more than a little dishonest. Orson Welles saw himself the exact same way. He made a movie called F for Fake about how much he and other people were fakers and the artistry behind that, which is really amazing. And Chimes at Midnight, as a result, takes this strange thing about Shakespeare is that his characters are still very cogent in some regard.
That's right, they are.
And it manages to make them do that. It manages to make Falstaff do that. And that's a strange thing because Falstaff is a terrible person. He kind of is. He's not a good person. He's a coward at very least.
You can try to be like, there's some good points, but the bad outweigh like more or less like the good.
But that was mentioned. And that sort of thing, to recognize it, like to draw parallels between John Falstaff and Orson Welles, it might be in bad taste, but food for the food god.
Yes.
And among other things, there were these pronouncements that you could make of Falstaff that you could also make of Orson Welles, because that persona that Welles inhabited so well and so vividly that even in those commercials for wine, like, French champagne, have no wine before it's time. I don't know if that was a good impression. Let me know in the comments. But
let us know.
Yeah, I just threw myself esteem a little more. That sort of adaptation is what keeps these things alive, and that's what was recognized in that bit, but they didn't go in depth on that, and that's kind of what you need to do for these. Especially, I want to know how they do that for Cervantes. Apparently, this is according to Marcos, there was an adaptation of Don Quixote as a television series starring Fernando Rey, who, correct me if I'm wrong, I think was the drug kingpin in The French Connection. I think that was him.
Audiences might not be able to see my face, but my eyes just went real wide and round.
Like, yeah, he as Don Quixote, I can kind of see it, actually. Fernando Rey's got that. I've seen him in a couple of other movies from that era. Like, he's kind of got that sort of weird, kind of grizzled charm. I can see Don Quixote doing that. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really learn about that, and as a result, I think I came out of Shakespeare and Cervantes without the information I came for.
The one thing I was kind of hoping to hear from you is that with Cervantes, we only really know about, like, Don Quixote. We don't really...
Yeah.
Like, especially in, like, the Western part of the world. I'm pretty sure in Spain, they might, like, talk about, like...
Spain's in the Western part of the world.
I know, but you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
America. Yeah. North America.
We are not America.
North America.
Okay, there.
America, Canada. Like, we don't really know about his other works, like...
Well, he was a dramatist.
Dumancha, yeah.
He was a dramatist, according to Marcos, Spanish author. Not a good one, according to him. And which is interesting, because Shakespeare is not really known for any one work over the others, whereas Cervantes most definitely is.
Yeah, and I was kind of like hoping that we would get to know more about his works and how that maybe it would connect with Shakespeare.
No, nothing about them, really. Some about Cervantes, nothing about Shakespeare.
All right.
Personally.
Well, we'll talk more about Writers' Festival. We do have a few messages that you guys want to hear about. So after these messages, we'll come right back. This is The Arts Report, October 26th. I'm your host, Ashley.
And Jake.
And we'll be right back after these messages.
The East Van Go-Go's are pleased to announce a benefit concert and brunch Sunday, November 6th at the Trout Lake Community Center. Proceeds benefit the Grandmothers to Grandmothers Project of the Stephen Lewis Foundation, supporting African grandmothers who are raising children orphaned by AIDS. The event combines delicious home cooking and soul-stirring live performances from Illiterati. Seating is limited, so reserve a ticket now by emailing eastvangogos@gmail.com. And where are you from?
more dreadful sacrifice.
Close it down.
The music you're listening to is completely electronic.
Only a fool would ignore this.
I'd like to demonstrate for you some of the rather more weird kinds of sounds.
See how relaxed you're getting?
Every Sunday night at 7 o'clock here on CITR 101.9 FM is More Than Human, your weekly guide to all that is new, weird and wonderful in the world of electronic music. So please join me, Gareth Moses, for electronic music old and new, inane comments and the occasional sacrifice. More Than Human on CITR.
And welcome back to the Arts Report. You're listening to CITR Radio 101.9 FM, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory in Vancouver. Let's go back to the Writers' Festival. I actually had the potential to interview a wonderful writer, a memoirist, Teva Harrison, and you'll actually be able to get to the full interview on our website. We'll have it up for you on our SoundCloud as well. Very interesting. So Teva Harrison was diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer at the age of 37, and she wrote this beautiful memoir called In Between Days. And in this graphic memoir, it is a series of illustrations and comic strips that she had kind of drawn herself, and a topic surrounding her life, you know, after being diagnosed with cancer. And it also has short personal essays on what it kind of like meant to her to live with the disease. And the book is actually a 2016 Governor General's Literary Award finalist. It's quite a personal book and a very honest book. She confronts the heartbreaking kind of like truth with kind of like the crisis of identity that one goes through when one is faced with such a disease. She even talks about, you know, what it was like, you know, being a lifelong vegetarian, that she had to use experimental drugs that may have been, you know, tested on animals. It's a really powerful book. Jesus. She struggles to reconcile her long-term goals with the uncertainty of her future, and balancing the innate sadness of, you know, cancer with the everyday acts of hope and wonder. And it is actually a, I'm not going to, like, you know, sugarcoat it. It is a book that deals with the harshness of reality, but it also deals with the hope of life as well. And if you have a chance to see it, In Between Days is quite redemptive. It's also even uplifting. And Teva Harrison, wonderful person to talk to, so smart, so kind. And if you want to see, if you want to hear our very intimate interview, it is, again, it'll be up online at our social media. So yeah, that was a really cool thing. You get to connect with a lot of cool people in at the Writers' Festival. And they have like really deep, thought-provoking panels. Like,
well, one great one I went to was Writer as Citizen.
What do you mean by Writer as Citizen?
So the thing is that there's actually one of the members of the panel was a UBC professor named Deb Campbell, and she wrote a book called Disappearance in Damascus about her journalistic ventures in Damascus and her guide, who was actually a guide fixer who was abducted.
He was abducted?
She was taken in by the secret police for working with her because it's Syria.
Yeah, and so if people don't know, Damascus is the capital and the largest city.
If you're Gary Johnston, Damascus is the capital of Syria.
Yeah, okay. It's the capital and the largest
city. Where
Aleppo
is also situated.
Of Syria.
There you go, Gary.
After Aleppo, prior to the civil war, it is now most likely the largest city in Syria due to, you know, decline in population, especially what happened in Syria.
Also one of the longest permanently settled cities in the world.
That's
one of the longest running permanent
settlements. It's a World Heritage Center, actually.
It is. Yeah. And it's that was one thing was a, and this is about more or less as a writer what you're obligated to do given those abilities. And in this case, it was what she could try to do to help her guide, to help the situation there, which, as we are very patently aware, even though, you know, most news right now is devoted to an orange-haired tyrant possibly rising up, there's a problem going on in that part of the world. There has been for some time.
It's strife
currently,
and struggle. That's right.
And this does go into depth about that. This does go into depth about the problem in Iraq from 2003. Like the funniest thing while reading this, not funny if you like, is that some of my earliest memories of having an understanding of politics was watching Robin Williams stand up comedy and mocking George Bush over Iraq.
Yep.
And that came around. It was just this really dark recollection, because that was a huge, you know, kicked off the millennium with an immense feat of military incompetence, and that was really very patently remarked upon there.
Yep.
It was a good book for that. And that there were three other people on the panel, though, and they all were confronting the issue that this book did actually mention specifically, which was, as a writer, what can you do? Because I'm in English.
Yep.
As far as liberal arts degrees go, that's a one of middling power at best. And the thing
is,
the
strongest powers.
Yeah, there are times when, I probably am nervous about calling myself a writer is because that seems to be a secondary act to me. It seems to be an act of reporting, act of making things that, when push comes to shove, may not matter at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, there are notes like that. Somebody might say Shakespeare saved my life. I've heard that said before.
Yeah.
Because
I've had a lot of people like authors save my life.
Yeah. No, because I know theater personnel have been through AA, and I can see that happening. But in situations like a war zone, for example, you're being a writer and you're being able to do anything, from my perspective, is really limited, and that's terrifying. That's a feeling of paralysis in the face of these foundational issues.
So you can only write on and you can't.
Yeah, you can only really report something happening and hope somebody does something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the different ways of confronting that. So the other panelists were Noah Richtler, who was a rather funny guy. He ran for office for the NDP in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a book about that. He read an excerpt about that. That was actually kind of entertaining. There was Christopher was another fellow who... He wrote prose poems about going to Afghanistan, and he actually was driven around by American soldiers to do this because he's a cultural ambassador, and he's done that. He's done missions to, I think it was Iraq, Afghanistan, to try and build cultures there in Africa, telling them to – in Africa, he says that he had these young men guiding him around, and this woman with a child, she said, "What are you going to do about it?" He said, "I'm going to write about it." And the young man's like, "Oh, we could do that." Mm-hmm. And he said, "Do it." And they did. And they're still doing that now, which is good. You know, this developing art. I mean, it's more possible to do that now than it ever was because technology for things like filmmaking is cheaper.
It's much more easier too.
But it's one of those things that to me it's really sort of a Sisyphean errand. It seems like one at times to try and fix the world through art because of the ways it can also be used very easily against that.
Propaganda being one.
Yeah. Which is the fourth commentator actually remarked on the third option. His name is Wade Davis. He's an anthropologist, which is forgetting.
Forgetting.
When you forget things. Like the, as long as we're talking, you know, about Iraq, the many world heritage sites got that 3,000-year-old heritage sites that got bombed to nothing. Or the fact that, like, when you have people like when forces, when insurgent extreme, when extremist insurgents, got into places, they destroyed the museums. They tried to erase any history that got like these are the same people who shot ice makers and barbers because clean shave and cubed ice didn't exist in the time of the Prophet Muhammad, which I'm pretty sure most practitioners of Islam believe is so many degrees of insane. It goes past the plane of norm. It goes past any relation
to
normalcy.
But of course, there are extremists on every side.
And Davis was talking about the fact that. There is, of course, the very old argument, you have to understand your own history so you don't repeat it, which is true.
It is extremely true.
But also there's the fact that you need to also make your own future, which is something that which is a responsibility.
This is actually very interesting that you mentioned that. Do you think that especially with how the elections are being done, not only in the states but in here, that people do don't really learn anything from history, or they ignore the bad things from history, but they remember the glory days and they want to keep on, like, you know, riding that nostalgia wave.
I think so. If we're talking about that, then the thing is that the sentiment that I am very, very well aware of, because this is a sentiment that people in my demographic, like young white males, sometimes get the feeling they're cheated.
Mm-hmm.
And I can never figure out why, because as a young white guy, look, as unusual as a young white guy's perspective may be in things, I feel fine.
Mm-hmm.
I feel pretty fine about things, but that may not be universal because my situation is different from many others, as is everybody else's. And mm-hmm. the thing is that there is this bitterness, this nostalgic bitterness mm-hmm. that comes back to it. And what that translates to is a desire to instill an order that never existed
yep.
on events where it can't take place. And this is actually mentioned, Wade Davis, I cannot remember who he's quoting, but anyone who thinks they can change the world foundationally is dangerous and wrong. Mm-hmm. And that's true to an extent, because people who want to see immediate change, there's only really one way to see immediate change. It's seldom positive and usually violent.
Is it a revolt?
Is it a revolt? It could be, but it's usually equates to that same thing. If you want, mm-hmm. was that's the same motivator behind, well, to Godwin it, fascism. It's mm-hmm. a common thought is that in fascism, there's a strongman argument, which entails a swift and absolute solution, which
yes.
doesn't happen in reality and certainly doesn't happen in democracy because of the nature of the system,
mm-hmm.
which is a good thing, because what that does is it errs on the side of caution to the people who are actually living it. And the problem is, if you want to ask my opinion on,
yeah.
on the matter, is that people take it for granted but are uninformed about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can take democracy for granted because that's technically a right that can be considered, if you depending
yeah.
on how you interpret the Constitution,
like
you have
breathing.
right to freedom, you know,
yeah.
it's entailed through that. But if you don't understand how to apply that right and to use that right, it's the equivalent of giving a 2-year-old a hand grenade.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when that power is controlling what is still, by leaps and bounds, the strongest country in the world,
mm-hmm.
then that's an extremely dangerous proposition. And that's a fault, in my opinion, of education.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you're American.
Yep.
So you probably have a more direct perspective on this than I do in some ways, because I have never lived there.
Well, my parents lived there, but I actually, I do have a Canadian citizenship too. So
mm-hmm.
people are like, I do too. And it is a little bit frightening. And it's very interesting how like the two, you know, political structures are kind of like in place. Like Canada is like a parliamentary kind of like system in which,
yeah.
you know, there aren't just two parties. There's like more parties, so people still get a number of representatives, whereas
and there's a certain requirement towards cooperation
yeah.
too, because without that you wouldn't be able to do anything.
Yeah, but in the States, if you don't cooperate, you just shut it down.
Yeah, or you reach a stalemate.
Yeah,
which happened with the
happened so long in our lives.
Oh yeah,
yeah, we just hear nothing but stalemate.
Yeah, well, actually, we really, when you come to think of it, we've been so my the first presidency I ever was aware of was Bush,
mm-hmm.
and that kind of shaped, still has shaped my POV towards the American political system.
It still does. Yeah.
It's come around to the point where you can either vote for the Republican or Donald Trump, which is the funny thing is that I don't hate Hillary Clinton. I don't
mm-hmm.
understand why people do,
mm-hmm.
because there's never been a single clean politician in history. There's not going to be one now. Like
I would say, but that's okay.
No. There isn't, and you can. There's accusations that can be made, but there's accusations that can be made
mm-hmm.
to some degree, depending on your leanings towards everybody,
mm-hmm.
and it depends on perspective and it depends on scale.
Mm-hmm. So talking about perspective, talking about scale, going back to writer as citizen,
do you think that really drifted far away from?
No, not at all. It's still about
yeah.
that kind of thing, like. How much power does a writer have in a, you know, when they are a citizen of that kind of structure, or if they're not a citizen of that kind of structure, do their words have any meaning because they're from there or they're not from there?
Well,
what happened to that story at the end with the person getting kidnapped?
So she was returned. She lives in this. She lives in Chicago now.
Okay, great.
She was released,
mm-hmm.
and. This was due to – it wasn't really due to ventures. It seems, from what I could gather, due to the fact that the government was just exhausted. Like, they couldn't figure out a use. She didn't know anything.
Yeah.
Like, she wasn't an insurgent. They accused her of human trafficking.
Yeah.
And selling guns, which she was not doing. And eventually there's just no information.
Mm-hmm.
And she came back. So she is still living there. That was sort of a happy ending.
Okay.
I mean, she's an Iraqi immigrant in Chicago, so she's having a bit of a rough time of things. But her children are in school; they're doing pretty well, and according to the book, so that there is hope in that regard.
All right, great.
And the impact of writing, what I got from the aggregate is that you can have an effect, but you will never know when it is.
That's true.
It's pretty random. And that's the thing about the Arab Spring was brought up, because of course it was. The Arab Spring spread through social media, which is the easiest way to, really the easiest way to get any writing venture out there in a way that wasn't possible before, but that is very much
part of our times. It is. It's actually very, very interesting too how much social media is now becoming, like, now we are becoming writers and we were citizens first. So you know how a lot of people are like reporters now? Just because they have, like,
bloggers,
you know, bloggers, but I'm just even saying, you know, random people on Twitter. They are updating people on, like, live news that is happening.
Funny thing is, there's a zombie book called Feed, which is set in a future where there's a zombie invasion, and bloggers replace journalists because the media didn't report zombies, so they got purged by the government when they government got set back up what they did was they purged the media and they let the bloggers do what they want, which sounds like a Tumblr dream, but it's actually is a good book, a good speculative fiction book, and that actually would work excellently with Girl with All the Gifts. Well, we should come back to that one, actually.
We should come back to that one because you actually checked it out, right?
I did check out Girl with All the Gifts, and I got a few things to say about that, but That's after we get through the important things.
No, they're all important. But most importantly is, how did you feel about this panel?
About this panel, I thought it was useful. I thought it was uplifting at some points because I didn't feel profoundly useless in what I do for not if not for a living, then as really an act of love.
Yep.
And that, for me, is very, very good because I feel that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I highly recommend Disappearance in Damascus. It's a good book.
And I have a question for people who are now kind of like intrigued by all the, you know, panels and all the discussions and all the writers that come to Writers Fest. Now that you went to a few of them, what would you kind of recommend that people do? Just so that people know, it is already over, but next year they will be back.
I would recommend Writers Fest next year. I'd really recommend going event by event if you don't think you're if you like really a personal experience that's not so much about the book involved, that there's readings but they're not really about the books involved, at least not in my observance, then yeah, you're gonna like this. But if you're doing this to get the pulse on the book itself, no, you're not gonna get your money's worth. You're going to get an excerpt that's really a teaser from the book. So if you want, my recommendation is to read Disappearance in Damascus. It's a good book. There's depressing moments, but it is good. It's very good. It's a good piece of writing, and it supports our UBC faculty.
Yep.
And maybe check out the other books. I can't really give any of them a name check recommendation because I haven't read them.
Mm-hmm.
But the passages from Mr. Rickler's book was quite funny.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. A lot of the time, I'm just glad they exist.
And just so people know, like, they have a lot of different authors from a lot of different fields of study. There are comic book people. There are people who do fiction, nonfiction, local history, national history, world history. There's a lot of different writers out there. So if one thing is not your thing, there will be a panel dedicated to maybe something that you like and you're like, oh, really niche. But look, they did have something on like different types of cats or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And there can be something you get. But like for the ticket price, I'm saying is that
you got to choose wisely.
It's a shot in the dark. If you just like being on Granville Island like I do, then yeah, certainly. It's as good a show to go to as... Well, yeah.
And again, Writers Fest is over, but do check out next year. I think they'll be back again around this time of the year. All right. So after that, really cool. Thank you for the in-depth kind of like recollection of Writers Fest.
Thanks.
There is a new show in town just premiered yesterday. If you're interested in a little bit of a clowning around, it is called The Pianist. It's presented by The Kulch.
Holocaust movie?
No.
With Adrian Brody? What the?
No.
How is that a comedy?
No. Let me finish the entire title. The Kulch presents The Pianist, a concert catastrophe.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Because I was going to say that one was...
It's not that very comic, no.
No.
But this one is. It is performed by Thomas Monckton of New Zealand with Circo Aereo of Finland. It started yesterday, October 25th. It is until November the 6th at York Theatre. Running time is about 55 minutes, no intermission. and I guess I would call it like a circusy kind of play. At the peak of high society entertainment sits the pianist. Impeccable in every aspect, he glides graciously through life, never placing a foot out of step. He is, in a word, perfection. Or at least that's what he thinks he is. The Pianist is a solo comic contemporary circus piece by Thomas Monckton, centered on, in, under, and around one of the most magnificent of all musical instruments, the grand piano.
I agree with that.
Yeah. So Circo Area is an international contemporary circus group from Finland that's based in Finland and France. And Thomas Monckton actually trained at New Zealand's only circus school, Circo Arts, and at the Physical Theatre School of Jacques Lecoq in Paris.
New Zealand and Finland. So they're literally at opposite sides of the globe.
I know. And he also studied in France, too.
Huh.
Mm-hmm. So the
good Lord, the airfare.
Right? So The Pianist is, again, it is about a man who plays piano. He thinks he's, like, the greatest. And the main conflict is that every time he's getting ready to play the piano, something goes horribly wrong.
That's what I said when I was learning the piano. That's exactly it. That's
so people are very into physical comedy, a little bit of like old school clowning and buffoonery. It is a very fun piece to see. There is a lot of music, and this can be technically a multi-language or no language piece, meaning that there are no spoken lines whatsoever.
What?
Yeah, no spoken lines whatsoever. There's also a bit of miming involved too. It's very you know, French mime in style at some places. There's the blend of the traditional and the modern clowning.
Well, speaking of physical comedy, dialogue, really bizarreness in the French, isn't there a Samuel Beckett show going on?
There is a Samuel Beckett show going on.
That just kind of jogged my memory there.
Yeah, we'll get right onto it. And that's actually at UBC, but this one is at the York Theater at 639 Commercial Drive, Vancouver, BC.
Oh, the York. That's where I saw Heather's.
Yeah, that's where we saw Heather's.
Yeah.
It was really good. Really nice venue, too. So if people don't know, pretty good stage, really comfortable seats. And if...
Unless you take the bus I took to get there, in which case, you know, looks like, you know, M&M's neighborhood.
Yeah, the interior is great. The exterior,
like 8 Mile M&M, not current.
Okay.
Yeah.
No. But it is actually really, really fun. When we went yesterday, was opening night. We had a lot of children there. They were so excited to see it because there is a lot of audience participation. So Christine, of course, was like enthralled because she loves audience participation. She doesn't, right? But it was really great. And the thing that I thought was really cool was how athletic and how physically demanding some of the clowning routines
are. That's full contact piano.
Full contact piano.
Exactly.
Yeah. And people don't know it, but clowning is actually hard work. I was like, oh my God, that looks so hard.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, that makes Stephen King's It make more sense.
Anyways, if you are interested in watching The Pianist, it is really good for children. I was actually seated next to a kid the entire time. They were enthralled with the piece. They didn't get bored at all. Very interesting and quite a fun family night to go to if you want to. October 25th to November 6th, York Theater. And you were right. There is Beckett happening. It's called Beckett 16. Very interesting at UBC. And let's talk about Beckett 16 again. It is directed by MFA directing alumnus alumnus Gerald Vanderwood. And the theater legend Norman Young is going to join the alumni cast in Beckett 16. So it's going to be very interesting. So if people don't know, Norman Young is a legendary figure in British Columbia, especially in the entertainment world. He is a UBC professor emeritus and the co-founder of the BC Entertainment Hall of Fame and a former member of the Canada Council. So for many years, he was actually the chair of the Vancouver Civic Theatres Board and received the Civic Merit Award from the City of Vancouver.
He's got stripes.
He's got a lot. He's the founder of the BC Arts Festival. He was chair of the BC Arts Board and has been a director of the Vancouver Museum, Vancouver Playhouse Theatre Company, the Vancouver Archives, and the Vancouver Children's Festival, and is honorary vice president
of PAL. If it starts with Vancouver, he's probably been involved somehow.
He was very, very, very much involved. And this is actually Norman's fifth show with the theater alumni group, and they did something called Beckett 15 last year too. So Beckett's 16. As you can tell, the 16 comes from 2016. And it's going to be pretty interesting. It is at the Freddie Wood. It is on November 3rd to the 5th only.
And it's like a collection of Samuel Beckett shorts.
It's a collection of Samuel Beckett shorts, that's right.
So does it say which ones?
On the site, if you're looking to see, it doesn't really...
Okay, that's. I guess that's fair. Like, I'm just trying to think, because mm-hmm. I've read more Samuel Beckett than I probably should have. You kind of have to, considering theater now, because his influence is that overarching.
It is. It is quite overarching, and it's going to be very interesting. Not only is Norman Young going to be there, but other alumni like Beverly Bardal, Cam Cronin, Deb Pickman, Joe Prosek, Tom Schulte, and it's going to be really encompassing of Beckett's work. We're going to play a short clip that is found on the UBC website for you guys so you can hear a little bit.
Don't worry, it won't make any more sense in person either. And that is why hanging yourself to try to get an erection is a terrible idea.
All right. What?
Oh, the mic was off. Okay, well, hey, thank God.
No, jokes aside. So for Beckett 16, it is it looks to be very visually stunning. If you go and see the short
as
clip. As we're telling you over the radio, so we'll try our best to describe it. The short clip that we played for you, it looks like the acting is going to be very, very phenomenal. A lot of moments of silence, but just coded and filled with meaning.
Yep.
So if you do have time, we strongly recommend seeing the show November 3rd to the 5th, 2016, at 7:30 p.m. at the Freddie Wood Theater. It is only November the 3rd to the 5th. Students for is $10, adult is $15.
So it's not a Halloween show.
It is not a Halloween show, but...
I've been thinking, Halloween coming up.
Halloween is
everybody's got to have, like, some kind of Halloween feature. I'm seeing all sorts of like things in review shows about that. Like there's, your Nightmare on Elm Street. It's the actual Halloween movie. That's what the Film Sock had last year. Actually, this week, there is the Film Sock in the theater in the Nest. I can never remember what that theater is called. Performance Theater, that's it. Mm-hmm. Is Mother Joan of the Angels and the Devils, which are both sort of nunsploitation movies.
Uh-huh.
It's sort of Halloween-y. Last year there was Halloween on Halloween, which was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
But like everybody's got to have a Halloween. Like there was Rob Zombie's 31 came out a little bit ago. I actually saw that a couple days ago.
Did you like it?
Yeah, it's okay. I think Rob Zombie is a good director, but his style kind of throws me off. Like it's just, it's just not for me.
Yeah, that's okay.
It seems really trashy at times, and this is no exception. But there was one performance in this that was really good.
What was that?
The villain. No, that Malcolm McDowell's like the overarching villain. This villain's name is Doomhead. The guy who plays him looks kind of like Mac's dad from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Yes.
He looks very much like that guy.
Right.
It's like the build of his face, the sort of menacing demeanor. And the movie introduces him sort of monologuing to a guy he's about to check out. And the guy starts pleading with him after about a page and a half of this guy giving a monologue, smoking a cigar. And this, like, you can see for the look in this guy's eyes, it's just people have had better success talking down Jason Voorhees.
Yeah.
He's going to die. And the guy does do it. And he, it's basically, I watched a review of this.
Yeah.
And the review described it as Texas Chainsaw Massacre meets The Running Man. And I have mixed opinions on both of those movies, but it's actually like this Doomhead guy I would recommend solely for it because you're going to see cosplays of this guy. You're going to see white grease paint, probably shirtless to the waist, blood running down his nose with a cigar. That's him. He's scary in the movie. Like he would have honestly, he would have made a great Joker in Suicide Squad. I think he could have. Oh. But there's a lot of what ifs for that movie. Right. But that's 31 for the 31st for Halloween, because it's set on partially on Halloween. It goes overnight into the next day. So this is technically, they didn't really call it Halloween. But like, some people watch Halloween on Halloween. I like Halloween 3, the one without Michael Myers in it.
Is that your favorite Halloween movie?
Movie for Halloween or movie in the Halloween series? In the Halloween series, but yes, by a long shot.
No, I mean like just in general for the holiday Halloween.
I like Halloween 3 for Halloween because it's not like, in all honesty, it is not a deeply scary movie, but it's like a really good Twilight Zone episode. Mm-hmm. And it's also good. There's an easy way to play a drinking game with it, which is a good barometer for a Halloween movie. Mm-hmm. But that is, yeah, that's a good one for Halloween. If you want my recommendation, probably Halloween 3. Mm-hmm. Or you could watch The Girl with All the Gifts.
The Girl with All the Gifts.
Yeah, with good.
We talked about it quite briefly last 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, I did. I saw it. I actually did see it at the tail end of VIFF, and that's a good movie. I'm not a big fan of zombie movies because, honestly, there are a lot of things I can watch easily. Like,
yep.
Rob Zombie movies do not scare me. They don't really. Like, I don't know if that's just the way they're made, but it's just the content there. Insane rednecks, witches, don't scare me. Zombies scare me because zombies end the human race. Insane rednecks do not end the human race. They might elect Donald Trump, but they won't end the human race.
Okay.
And, yeah, The Girl with All the Gifts does kind of show that ending. Mm-hmm. We're going to tantalize you with that one because this is a really good movie and we want to support Glenn Close in movies, so go see it.
Go support Glenn Close in movies.
I get a kick out of seeing Glenn Close in movies because like, I remember seeing her on Damages and mm-hmm. like she is intense. Like she's really good.
Yeah, she is.
I wonder if she'll be in the new Guardians of the Galaxy movie because she was in the first one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And with Girl with All the Gifts, one thing I also really liked about that is that it had some parts you were kind of like, oh, I know it's going to happen. But there were other parts that surprised you, that actually subverted some of the conventions within the genre.
What it reminded me a lot of, and this weirdly towards the end too, was Children of Men, the Alfonso Cuarón movie with Clive Owen, which, yeah, that's a good movie.
Yeah.
Like takes place in post-apocalyptic Britain, problems with the continuation of the human race, yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. And there's sort of this journey across Britain to try and do that with a child involved. And this one, it was good. The zombies, too, like the mm-hmm. zombies as just being a symptom of some other life form. Mm-hmm. That was Last of Us Zombies. You were right about that. Like that,
I know. I said it was very mm-hmm. Last of Us. So if you know the actual video game series mm-hmm. Last of Us, the zombies are
fungal. Like fungal. It's a fungus that infects the brain and spinal cord.
That's right. And so when I saw the premise in the movie, I was like, wow, it's mm-hmm. very, very Last of Us. And I won't spoil it if people want to play Last of Us, even though it's been out for years now. Or if people want to go see the movie, we're not going to spoil how it ends and how the fungal part is done. But it's actually quite it's actually much more cooler because they did more with the fungal thing.
They did, and what they really did do, which is interesting in a lot of zombie movies, because I've seen a few. And there's a reason I don't like the genre, but I've seen a few, and this one was strange in that it wasn't all consuming doom.
Yeah,
like
wasn't.
That's one thing about The Walking Dead I can't watch is the fact that it seems like that is the end of life, is like the end of humanity, and that wasn't this movie. Mm-hmm. And if you watch the movie, you know what I'm talking about. But it's more about adaptation than death, which that's a great message, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you can't really tell me about Walking Dead. I'm so heartbroken. I won't spoil it for anybody, but I'm just heartbroken.
I haven't seen it. I haven't seen a lot of it.
No. That's okay. I'm just heartbroken. But that's a really good movie. I hope it actually
That'll be in theaters.
I hope it premieres in like.
If American Honey is going to be in theaters, that's going to be in theaters.
Or, you know, maybe Netflix will pick it up. But a very, very interesting movie. I love the different types of protagonists that they have.
Yeah, they do, because they do humanize the characters pretty well. Like, that's one thing about the that military guy was the villain from 28 Days Later. he kind of was, like, the uh-huh. human villain from 28 Days Later. He just uh-huh. kind of acted that way. Mm-hmm. And they did have the archetypes, though, that are in a zombie movie.
Yep.
Like the military person, the obsessed scientist, the everyman private, the compassionate person, that, so forth and so on.
The infected person.
Yeah.
They
did brilliant things with that one, though.
Yeah,
that was like,
but the way that they did it was really brilliant. And
this movie was about turning that trope on its head.
Yep. So if people are interested, go watch The Girl with All the Gifts. There's a reason why we're talking about it 2 weeks later. It's pretty good.
I realize with my diction, I keep like I'm sounding like I'm. It's The Girl with All the Gifts, which is like sounds like The Girl with All the Repeating Images. But,
no.
Small self-contained video clips, but no. There's no gifts in the movie.
Anyways, that is our show for today. Thank you so much for listening.
Hey, before we leave, Ashley, what's your favorite Halloween movie?
My favorite Halloween movie? Are you kidding me? Oh, my God. Well, I'll just say this. Boys and girls of every age.